As I mentioned, we've been looking at the resurrection week. You can see 15 up there. We've been looking at it for a little while, but we're going to continue on. Last week, as we were in discussion about this, we were looking at those moments leading up to the actual crucifixion. We examined how Jesus was brought back to Pilate. Pilate tried every way he could to get out of it, but could not find a way. The Jewish leadership was just unrelenting. The crowd continued to cry for a crucifixion. And so at the end, Pilate washes his hands, symbolically of trying to remove his guilt, and proceeded to give Jesus over to the mob and was sent to be crucified. Well, essentially, his soldiers took charge of him and led him away. So, that's what we're going to pick up this evening. Now, just for a reminder on our timeline here, we are still in the Friday period. We're going to talk about the time in just a minute, but this is the day period of the Jewish time, the Jewish day. And so I've got a couple of different scriptures up there. We're going to try to look at each of them as we move forward. But we're going to look at a couple of events. So the first thing we know of note is the mocking Jesus endured as he is led to the cross. If you go to the Matthew's account, after releasing Barabbas, Matthew 27, verse 27, the text says, "The soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters." This is after he'd gotten up from the judgment seat and had left. They then take Jesus inside the headquarters. They gathered the whole battalion before him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, and they twisted together this crown of thorns. They put it on his head and put a reed in his hand. This mocking idea that has been ongoing continues. The text goes on to say that they then knelt down before him and mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they're giving this chant out. So I'm trying to think about the best way to do this. So let's talk about... I'll come back to it. I'll stick with my order. I was going to change it, but I'm not going to do that. All right, so they're mocking him. Verse 30 says they spit on him. They then took the reed and struck him, verse 30. And then it was after they had mocked him, they then stripped the robe off of him, put on his original clothing on him, and this is where they led him away to be crucified. All right, so that's Matthew's account. Mark's is very similar to this, with a few caveats that we'll get to in just a minute. But it's very similar. Luke, also very similar. So this is one of the times when the synoptic gospels really line up pretty much all the way through, except for as Jesus is traveling, Luke adds a little bit here to what's going on in mentioning this statement he makes to the to some of the people there as he passes by. If you go to Luke 23, 28 or 27, tells us that there was a great multitude of people and of women who were mourning and lamenting him. So you in this crowd have a real mixture of different attitudes. So you have those who jeer him, those who mock him, and then on the other side you have those who are lamenting, those who are wailing or crying. And so it really is kind of a melting pot of different attitudes toward Jesus. Well, in verse 28, he does turn to them who are lamenting him, and he says, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves." and for your children. For behold, the days are coming when they will say, blessed are the barren and the wombs that never bore and breasts that never nursed. Then they will begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. For if they do these things when the wood is green, what will happen when it is dry? Very kind of an interesting statement. It's kind of hard to define exactly all he's talking about here. First, you note that he's turning the concern away from himself and on the people. And so when he says that instead they ought to weep for themselves, what is he meaning by that? Why should they be the ones weeping?
Bad times are coming.
Okay. In what way? What's that? For following him? Okay. Yeah, so you're talking about like his followers later on are going to suffer under persecution? That very well could be it.
Mm-hmm. I think also if he was thinking about the destruction of Jerusalem.
Okay. And that's where my mind went first, is what's going to happen in AD 70 when Rome comes in to destroy the city and what's going to happen to the Jewish people. But again, he's not clearly defined which direction he means that. Dwayne?
Mm-hmm. 40 years that basically the country of Israel disappeared.
Yeah. And the thing to kind of, in my mind, leans credence to he is projecting toward what's going to happen to Jerusalem when Rome comes in, is he calls them daughters of Jerusalem. He doesn't say my daughters, my children, right? But he's pointing more toward to the people of the Jewish nation. And this seems to me to be a statement more against the Jewish people. And what's going to happen to them. And he talks later, he says, they do this when the wood is green. What will they do when it's dry? What do you think that may be? What's he trying to illustrate with that?
Well, I'm trying to get my head wrapped around that. I don't know, but it's 80, 70, and they are trying to escape. Everything's dry. That kind of thing, nothing's green. Can't conceal your
exit. Well, what I was thinking was the wood, young wood is green, right? But as it gets older and matures, it turns into more, it solidifies, and that growth process stops inside of that branch. And so now is the time for repentance, right? This is the time that they should be repenting. And yet you see their response to Jesus is very different. They're not responding in repentance. They're responding in mockery and trying to humiliate him and deny him. Right now is the time to make change. But once the wood is brown, once it dries, its growth is finished. The time is up. That's my take from what he's saying, and I think he's pointing toward what's coming. And there's going to be a time when it's you're not going to have opportunity to repent like you do right now. That's right. Yeah, and I agree. I think that's what I would agree with that interpretation.
Could you compare it to wood green, the flame of good, and
the
wood not good?
Mm-hmm. And again, I think that really applies well with that because right now they feel as though they're powerful, right? They're killing him. They seemingly have control over him. It's not going to be that way for very long. This is a false sense of control, security. So, prophetic, However you want to apply it, it's I think it's prophetic of coming times. And so Luke is the only one that points that statement out. I think that's interesting. But he does. And so after being mocked, Jesus is then given his cross to bear. I'll come back to John in just a minute. John really doesn't do as much with the lead up as the others do. But he's given his cross to carry. Let's talk about the cross for just a second. Now, most of us, let me say this at the first. There's a lot of information about the crucifixion process itself that is not set in stone. So there's certain things about it that we can't speak with a definitive nature. As I mentioned in a previous class, is the Romans didn't invent crucifixion. They perfected crucifixion in an evil way. Or, you know, it's one of those things where they really got good at what they were trying to accomplish with it. It was a brutal process for those who were being crucified. And so most often when we think about a cross, what do we picture? A T, right? You think of the T where you've got the upright member and then you've got the cross members down a little bit. And I'm not going to say that could not have been the design of the cross. It could have. But most likely, I think most of the evidence points to it not looking like that. That it looked more. So I'll also say this. There's not a standard way that they did crucifixion as far as the cross itself goes. There were times when they just simply took the cross beam and nailed it to a tree. And then sometimes they would have posts there that they would put the cross beam on. And so many have surmised that the cross looked more like a capital T than a lowercase T. Does that make sense? The cross itself, weight. Here's another thing. Did Jesus bear the whole cross through town? No. The upright member, it would have either been where he was taken or it would have been a tree itself. He would have carried the cross beam that his hands would have been attached to. The weight of that. In studying this, there's a big diversity of weight. It could have been anywhere from 60 pounds to 100 pounds. Either way, it's a lot of weight to carry on your back. But there's no definitive way that I have read or seen that says this was exactly what it was. Again, their goal was not to be rudimentary in their design of the cross. It was what they were doing to the victim or the convicted criminal on the cross. So it would have looked something, like this here. So we'll talk about the feet in a minute. The feet has kind of come under some scrutiny in how they were exactly placed. Some have believed there was something here to put the feet on and they would have been nailed down into it. I'm going to show you something in a minute where maybe that's not how they did it. And I'll show you that in just a minute. Here is a placard of what Pilate's statement may have looked like. Again, I'll talk more about that in a minute. But of course, that was placed at the top of the cross. We do know that. We're given some good information about it. So that's the cross. So he is made to bear his cross. How long did it take? I'm going to get more into the time in a minute, but again, we don't know exactly where Golgotha was. There's some guesses, but we don't know exactly how long that journey would have been. Let's think about Golgotha for just a minute before I talk about Simon. Golgotha, most translations will have that. What's the other name we use for where Jesus was crucified? Huh? The skull, right? That's the literal translation of the word Golgotha, right? Golgotha is a transliterated word. You ever heard of Calvary, Mount Calvary? Calvary is the Latin translation. Calvary refers to the skull. Right? We sing the song Mount Calvary. I don't know what image you had in your mind, but again, it's depicting the image of bone, right? Of the skull. So both of those are referring to the same thing. Along the way, we do know at this point, Jesus has endured a great deal physically, and he is unable to bear his cross on his own, probably indicating he was falling down, trying to heave this along, and was not having much luck at doing that. Now, Roman law allowed the Roman soldiers just to grab somebody out of the crowd. It's just your lucky day. There's some interesting things with Simon. Let's look at this. So we see three of the four Gospels all mention Simon. If you go to Matthew 27:32, it calls him a man of Cyrene. I've heard some people pronounce it Cyrene. I don't know if it's Cyrene or Cyrene, but that's who he is, Simon. Who else is called Simon? Simon's very popular, isn't it? We have a lot of Simons in Scripture. Here's another one, Simon. Mark gives us a little bit more information. This is who I want to think about for just a minute. So let's go to Mark chapter 15 and verse 21. Mark 15:21, and we'll also, no, we'll just look here. So the text tells us, Mark 15:21, and they compelled, the soldiers, compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. So here is this guy, Simon. I don't know why he's coming into the city, but he's a guy, didn't live in Jerusalem, but he'd come in to Jerusalem, maybe just simply for Passover. But he's there, and the soldiers grab him and say, I want you to help him bear his cross. And so Simon has no choice. He has to help him lug that up the mountain. He's probably also trying to help Jesus lug it up the mountain, right? Or trying to get Jesus up the mountain is what I'm trying to say. Now, I am fascinated with the background information that writers give us. I think it's interesting that Mark includes the statement, the father of Alexander and Rufus. Now, if you were a reader in the first century, why would a writer include that information to you? What now? Okay, so maybe you keep track of lineage. But Mark's the only one that includes this information. If you're writing a letter to a friend and you include another friend in it, would you include a friend that the other one didn't know anything about? Not necessarily, right? Maybe if you're trying to explain who that person is, but if you're just writing, you say, oh yeah, Joe was also there. Would you put Joe in there if the other person had no idea who Joe was? Because then you're inviting what? Like that person would be like, "Why? Who's Joe? Why Joe doesn't mean anything to me?" A writer is going to include people that his readers would probably know. Now this is fascinating. Now Mark, in writing his gospel, who did he write to? What audience? So Matthew wrote to who? Jews. And I believe his main target audience were Judean Jews, right? People who were very interested in the law. Who did Luke write to?
Gentile
Greeks, right? He's writing to Gentiles and Greeks. He writes in a very specific way. John's writing at the end of the first century. Who's he writing to? Christians. Christians. He's writing to Christians, right? But who is Mark writing to?
Romans.
Roman people. Now, this is fascinating. So, Alexander, I don't know much about Alexander. This is the only statement of Alexander that I know of. But Rufus, there is another Rufus. If you go to the book of Romans, Romans, interestingly enough, Romans chapter 16 and verse 13. Now, at the end of Paul's letters, he would often include salutations or greetings to people that would be in the proximity of those he's writing to. So if he's writing to Corinthians, he would, at the end of it, he'll write to some people he knows from Corinth, right? And he'll say, you know, greet them, basically. Well, Romans 16:13 says what? Very first person. Greet Rufus. Now, here is a Rufus in the Roman church that Paul is sending greetings to. Now, is this the same Rufus? Cannot say that with definitive nature. But it is interesting that in Mark's gospel, he includes those two young men. Now, I think without a doubt, you would have to say Alexander and Rufus were known by the Roman Christians. Now, whether this is the same Rufus or not, I cannot say definitively. But I do think it's an interesting tie. So, it says something about, I've often heard people say, well, I wonder what happened to Simon afterwards. Well, I think it's likely from Mark's writing that his family, at least, had a connection with the church. And his two sons are probably Christians, Alexander and Rufus. I don't know about Simon, but otherwise, why would Mark bring them up if they were just somebody nobody knew? So at least they had some association with the early church. I find that interesting. So it's a little bit about Simon. Simon would have helped him up to the mountain there on Golgotha's hill. And then probably would have been done with his duty as to regards to Jesus. All right, so as we move along in our text, we get to Mount Golgotha or the place of the skull, as it's literally translated. And there they begin the crucifixion process. All right. Make sure it wasn't something else I wanted to note there. All right, so let's talk about the crucifixion. I've kind of introduced this already, but let's talk a little bit about what was going on. So they would have, of course, held Jesus down or whatever they would need to do. I'm not sure he was going to be fighting a whole lot. But what he endured was going to be greatly painful. They would have put his hands down, and of course, there's been a lot of debate on this, on exactly where they nailed him. What we can at least have some reasonable surety of are what were driven into his hands were spikes that would have looked similar to what you see on the screen. Those would have been used by the Romans as what they used, these long spikes with a pointy end. Now, where were they driven? Some will say it was definitely had to be into the hand, that they were driven through his hands and he would have hung there. What's the problem with that? Is there a problem with it? Okay, so number one, one reason is not sure they would have held very well, right? Because they have to bear his weight. But there's a biblical reason why this is a problem. And this is more what I would lean on. What's the biblical reason why there's a problem with nailing in the hands?
No bones broken.
And doctors, people who have more expertise can tell me, but From what I understand, it'd be really hard to drive a nail of that size through a hand and not break a bone, because you have so many bones in your hands. So that's why it's led others speculate that where the nails were actually driven were here just behind the wrist, right? And you have that open space right there. It also would have given the more of a weight bearing on the wrist itself. And during that day, from what I understand, is the hand, when you're talking about the hand, you're talking from the elbow down, right? That would have all been included, and that wouldn't have been a problem as far as understanding. When he's referring to hands, he's could be referring to anywhere in that general vicinity. Do I know for sure? Nope, wasn't there. I can't speak with surety, but I know that I lean more toward it was probably here. Not that that's a big deal one way or the other, but just for information. So those would have been driven in. You can imagine the tremendous torture and pain of that, the agony that he's having to suffer through that. They place those two there. Now, what about the feet? All right. I didn't put that other picture back up here, but you remember some have been pictured with that little placement for the foot, little ledge. Could have been that. But we've actually had some recent discoveries of some people who had been crucified. Not Jesus, but other people who had been crucified. You can see up here, some archaeologists have discovered this here. That there is the ankle bone. And you can see the nail driven through the ankle bone. It's led some to surmise that in some of the crucifixions, maybe this doesn't apply all the time. Again, they don't have to do it the same way every time. But that the feet were instead placed not on a ledge, but on the side of the post. And the nails would have been driven through the ankle and into the wood. And like I say, there's evidence that that did happen from time to time. So thought that was kind of interesting to at least note that. Again, I'm no anatomy expert, but I think there is a place back here where it can be driven. Anybody better on the feet anatomy, you can help me out there. But that's a possibility, and I think some people are beginning to lean that direction. But if you are placing a nail and you're putting them on the platform, you can obviously see if that were the case, you would have spaces there to place the nail so it didn't break the bone. That would have definitely been possible. But don't you have less space here? I'm just feeling in my own hand. I just think it would be hard. But I don't know. Again, not there. Maybe it was done that way. Yeah. But just kind of covering some of the details. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Doy.
Well, one thing people forget is that, historically speaking, a lot of people that were crucified also had straps around the beams holding their hands and their feet there. So you didn't have to depend so much on the weight dragging off the nails in a lot of cases. So if he was spread out like this, some people think that there were straps around the beam and his hands were attached to them, and the nails protruded in whichever way they did it. And the same thing with the feet, that there were straps. A strap down there that went around the pole and kind of, for lack of a better term, held him up a little bit.
Yeah. And it may have been, it may be that. Again, I think we get to the same point where there's no, they don't have a crucifixion document that says this is the way crucifixions have to be done. And so, no. I'm just getting back to the point of, we're always going to have questions about some of these things because they've just, you're not going to, you know, you don't have a crucified person that's been mummified on a cross, right, to go look at. So we have found some evidence like this, right? That's definitive. We know some people were done that way, but it doesn't say all of them were done that way. And they could be done different ways. That's really, I'm assuming, a soldier's choice. As long as they get them up there. Now, I will say this too. The soldiers who are doing this, I'll get those pictures off in case you don't want to look at them. The soldiers' pay for that activity was based on how well they did, right? You know, you got to do a good job, you want to get paid. Also, part of their pay was casting lots for the clothing. We'll see that in just a minute. They would also have the spoils of what was left from the person. We'll talk about that in just a minute. So Jesus is led up to Golgotha. There he's placed on the cross and crucified. If you look in the Gospels, so each of them, I'm trying to remember this for sure. So I believe each of them, so if you go to Matthew 27:37, you see that Matthew notes that Pilate had put this piece of wood up there, this banner, that would have said, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. He did that. You also have Mark doing that, Mark 15:26 and following. But I want to look specifically. I'm trying to see if, interestingly enough, oh yeah. So Luke also does this in Luke 23:38. He only gives a really short documentation of it. But I want to go to John. John actually gives us the most. So John 19:19. John 19:19. This is what the text reads, the English Standard. John 19:19. Pilate also wrote an inscription and put it on the cross. What I think is one of the things that's not noted in the text is what prompts Pilate to do this. As far as I understand, there's no like historical command or directive for him to do this. If anybody has better information, you can let me know. But as far as I know, there's no Roman legislation that said he needed to put an inscription over each criminal. But he does. It read, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. So that's what it read out. Verse 20, many of the Jews read this inscription, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written, notice this, in Aramaic, in Latin, and in Greek. That's another interesting thing. Why did he do that? And if he's going to write it, why put it in three different languages?
Because that was his audience.
Yeah, but this is Pilate doing it. Remember, this isn't Jesus doing it. That's interesting.
I want to make sure everybody knows, you know, different people are speaking different languages, right?
Yeah, but my question again, though, is what motivates Pilate to do it? What's Pilate's motivation, huh? Mm-hmm. Yes, I don't know exactly what it was. Maybe it's just God's intervention here. He did at times use people who were not good people to do things. Like he used the high priest, you remember, to prophesy about that one man would die for the nation, right? But anyway, he puts it in those three different languages. So the chief priest of the Jews said to Pilate, do not write the King of the Jews. but rather, this man said, I am the king of the Jews. Pilate answered, what I have written, I have written. That's another interesting thing. They come to him, they're like, at least add on there that that's what he said. Don't just label him the king of the Jews. So, yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. So he's like, this is who he says he is, and I want him crucified anyway, so I'm going to put that up there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe so. Maybe it was just simply out of spite, right?
The three languages could have had something to do with the diversity of people that were in Jerusalem at that time, mm-hmm. too, because of Passover.
And he's clearly wanting to get the message out. Right, he's taking the time to put it in all three languages of the day. He's emphasizing that. Now, there were other languages spoken, but those were the majority languages spoken. So he puts it up there. Now, that's a true statement. He is the king of the Jews. He's the king of the world, king of kings. It also might go back to his earlier conversation with Pilate. Remember, he said, Pilate said, are you a king? He said, for this purpose I was born. For this, that's why he came into the world. Right? And so Pilate said, I've written what I've written. So in other words, I'm not changing it. It is up there. So they didn't get their way on this. They got their way with the crucifixion. They're not getting their way with changing the inscription. So you have Pilate write that sign. Any other questions or comments about that? All right, I'll introduce this next thing. And we'll come back to it. I only have less than 2 minutes. So another interesting thing is each of the Gospels know that Jesus is crucified between two criminals, one on each side. But it is only Luke that gives us a deeper conversation between the men. And I, again, find that very fascinating. If you go to Luke 23, we're given a conversation that, if you will read that before next week, I want to have a conversation about that, and then we'll move on into some of the other things going on. This has caused a lot of consternation amongst some over salvation, and we're going to talk about the deeper meaning of it, and we'll get into that next week. All right, again, thank you all so much for your comments and interest in this as we continue to look at this very important week. Next week, we'll pick this back up and move forward. We'll dismiss now and be rejoined for our devotional in just a moment. Thank you.